I Faith, Lesson 107, one of two lessons from the book of Daniel, and this is called The Three Statues. Today we're beginning a new unit, Unit 16, some of the later books of the Old Testament, the history. Daniel is often placed in the prophets, but I'm putting it here. Now, this is not a book about vegetarian fasting, or a way to predict the end of the world, or end-time events in the Middle East, ways that the book is typically misused. I will say this, though. It's a book that can help you and me with our faith, and it's also the kind of book typically banned by totalitarian governments. That is, nation states that demand complete allegiance from its citizens, even if that means suppressing their faith. Oh, and just a little point here. From Daniel 2 to 7, the text is in Aramaic. You know, only 1% of the Old Testament is in Aramaic. That was the imperial language of Persia, later became the main language of the Jews. The rest of Daniel's in Hebrew. So it was written to a bilingual audience or readership. Kind of interesting. Same as with Ezra. And that reminds, I think it reminded those people, they're living in two different worlds. And there's the world of God and his word, the Hebrew, and there's the world of the pagans. There's the world of those who don't regard God or they worship false gods. That's the Aramaic. Well, there are three statues, and the first one is well known. It's the statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2. We read this. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. And so he summons various experts. I'm condensing it here, if that's okay. And they came in and stood before the king. And he told them, I had a dream that troubles me and I want to know what it means. And they say, may the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we'll interpret it. So he has a dream. And sometimes when I have dreams, they're troubling. Sometimes they're fantastic, wonderful dreams, but I wish I could remember it. It's gone. Usually it's neither troubling nor all that great. It's just my mind dumping data in the night or something like that. But apparently he doesn't remember, or it seems to me he doesn't remember his dream, because he tells the experts they need to interpret it, but they also need to remind him of what he dreamt. So this dream takes place in 603 BC. And by the way, there's an old Babylonian text. Listen to this. If a man cannot remember the dream he saw, his God is angry with him. So, and maybe that's another reason Nebuchadnezzar is urgent. Well, the king replies to the experts, this is what I firmly decided. If you don't tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I'll have you cut in pieces and turn your houses into piles of rubble. But if you do interpret it, you'll get honored. And again, they say, well, yes, but tell us the dream and then we'll interpret it. He says, no, you're trying to buy time. You're conspiring against me. And eventually his experts, the astrologers, these people into not just astrology, but all kinds of things, say, no one can do that. This is impossible. Only the gods could reveal that kind of knowledge. And they don't live with us. We don't have that connection with them, because in Babylon and in most religions in the ancient world, God is distant and aloof. He doesn't really care. They say it's simply too difficult. And so Nebuchadnezzar is so angry, he says, okay, let's execute all the wise men in Babylon. And that includes Daniel. And that includes Daniel's three friends, whom we'll see in just a few moments. Well, eventually someone speaks sense. Daniel is that man. And he's brought before the king. And he says, look, no one can do this, but God can reveal the mystery. And Daniel tells him what he dreamt. And basically, the Babylonian king dreamt of a statue that at the top was gold. And as you move down the statue, it became silver and then bronze. And at the bottom, it was iron mixed with baked clay, mixed with ceramic. And then he sees a stone that falls upon the foot of the statue, and everything is reduced to just dust and is blown away. And meanwhile, that stone grows up to become a mountain that fills the earth. And that's a stone not cut with human hands. So that's God's kingdom. Wow. So it's a bit of a disturbing dream, particularly because when he interprets it, Daniel says, you, Nebuchadnezzar, you are that head of gold. Now, I know a lot of people like to say, this metal represents this kingdom and that represents that kingdom. It's difficult to know for sure. There are different possibilities on that. Most Christians and Jews have taken the fourth kingdom to be Rome, and that may well be right. But it's to focus there is to miss the point, I think. The point is that God's kingdom is eternal. That's the one you need to be loyal to. And another thought, when Goliath, also a very tall figure, was struck, he was struck in the head, and that was his undoing. The statue here is struck in its foot. Interesting. Now, what we're going to see is that the entire book of Daniel, and certainly the material we'll look at today and also in iFaith 108, is faith-building material for anyone going through a difficult time spiritually or just a disorienting time. Maybe you're in transition and it's just not clear what to do. Well, as Daniel ends the interpretation, he says, "The God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people." And then Nebuchadnezzar falls prostrate before Daniel. I mean, down he goes, pays him honor, and he orders that people should sacrifice or present incense to Daniel. It's Daniel. Daniel's a monotheist. He believes in one God. This would be, I mean, to accept worship, that would be a total denial of his faith. And the king then says to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries." Well put. So, Daniel has been captured as a youth along with his friends, brought to Babylon. He's been trained in this alien language and literature and culture, and he's retained his Jewish identity despite the great pressure to give it up. He's entering an alien thought world. That's so much like Christians today. I think this is a point Peter makes in 1 Peter 2:11 and many other passages of 1 Peter. We're in a world where we're viewed as strange, even if we're not odd. I know some of us are odd in a different way. But just the kinds of things Christians believe puts us in a small minority. And it's so much easier just to be cool and try to blend in. Daniel won't do that. And as we'll see with the next statue, neither will his friends, even if it means death. Chapter 3, and this is statue 2. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. That's 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide, kind of long and narrow, like a pencil. Okay. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And then he summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, officials to come to the dedication of the image. These are all people who have, these are various positions within the imperial government. And so everyone assembled, and they all stood before it. So this statue, I mean, you've just read Daniel 2, where he dreams about a statue, the king, and now he's setting up a statue. Like, did he forget his dream? Is he thinking that if he makes the whole thing of gold, then it will be permanent? He's deluding himself if that's the case. It's not uncommon for proud leaders and governments to erect huge statues. I'm not against statues in themselves unless they represent something evil or they demand worship. But in the ancient world, you've heard the phrase, the seven wonders of the ancient world, like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, right here with Nebuchadnezzar, something that he worked on. But two of them involve statues. There's the Colossus of Rhodes. Rhodes is an island in the Aegean Sea, and that was a statue even taller than Nebuchadnezzar's statue. It was a statue of Helios, that is the sun god. Another one would be the statue of Zeus at Olympia. Again, Zeus, the father of the gods. In Egypt, there at Memphis, there was a huge statue of Ramses II, probably the pharaoh of the Exodus. Herodotus, the Greek historian, speaks of two statues in Babylon, one of Zeus, right, and one that's human. Nebuchadnezzar, when the temple fell, 2 Kings 25, when the Jerusalem temple fell, tons and tons of gold were taken away. And it's quite possible that that gold is used here to make this statue. If so, this ties in very closely to Daniel chapter 5, where we'll be in the next talk. And also, this huge structure, I think, reminds us of Babel. Babel, which is Babylon, Genesis 11, people come together and they build this enormous structure to consolidate their control, to control the system, to not be scattered, to be strong. And God's not going to stand for that, monuments to human arrogance. Well, he's made this decree, Nebuchadnezzar, and the herald loudly proclaims, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do." And most commentators agree that this paragraph is making fun of this silly proclamation. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Therefore, as soon as they heard the music, mentioned again, everyone, all these different kinds of officials, fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. I mean, what is this silliness? I mean, he's almost daring people. Are you loyal to me or not? What right does the state have, the government, your country, to claim your allegiance before that of God? Does the state have the right to demand our ultimate allegiance? If the state tells us to do something that's forbidden in God's word, are we therefore permitted to do it just because the state authorizes it? I think not. I came across a pretty cool quote here. This is going back to the 1930s. As Adolf Hitler was coming to power, well, he was in power in Germany for 3 years at this point. And a fellow wrote this, Baldur von Schirach: whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany. Whoever serves Germany serves God. So when the state says, well, this is ultimate, and you don't have to choose between God and us, worship us, the state, and you are worshiping God. Well, that's simply not true. And to be burnt to death by the Babylonian king, and this is mentioned in other places in the Old Testament, what a horrible way to go. And if you know the story of Daniel's three friends, they refuse. And they say, God could rescue us from the fire, which he actually does, but even if he doesn't, we're not bowing down. And after they are rescued, and after Nebuchadnezzar sees an angel, perhaps, a fourth one walking around in the furnace, he says, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, these are Daniel's friends, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command. And therefore I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces, their homes be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save this way. Okay, well, good. Nebuchadnezzar is getting the point, we hope. Except that in chapter 4, yes, there's another dream. And this time it's a big tree. Again, it's this very tall thing. But he doesn't learn. And ultimately, he's reduced to insanity. He thinks he's a cow. He suffers from a condition called boanthropy, where you actually think you're a cow. Crazy. And finally, he acknowledges that God, Yahweh, that is, the God of the Jews, is sovereign. And we read this at the very end of chapter 4. Now, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just, and all those who walk in pride he's able to humble. Wow. Good. He's learning. Let's talk about the third statue. Well, the third statue is very similar to the first two. The first, a quotation from a fellow named Butterfield. Judgment in history falls heaviest on those who come to think themselves gods, who fly in the face of providence and history, who put their trust in man-made systems and worship the work of their own hands, and who say that the strength of their own right arm gave them victory. So here's the question. And what is that third statue? It's a statue to me. It's a statue to myself. Do I erect statues to myself, metaphorically speaking? Do I seek to build things that are catchy and visible, that will get people thinking highly of me? Pictures of myself, maybe selfies, like a lot of selfies. Do I have the attitude that the philosopher Rousseau had several hundred years ago? He said, if there were a single enlightened government in Europe, it would have erected statues to me. Do we demand that kind of attention? Are we making a statue out of our career, our reputation? Is it all about me? Is it about my image? Or is it about God's image, which is the image of Christ? This is the Christian application. The statue could be state, when the state claims our ultimate allegiance, nationalism. Do we care little about other parts of the world, but we care a lot about our own state, our own nation? Something's wrong here. It could be the system. We could worship the system on the plains of Dura, proclaiming the church instead of proclaiming Christ. Look at 2 Corinthians 4, 5. You see, God's kingdom is the true kingdom. Let's learn from the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, the statue of his dream, the golden statue that he set up, and let's beware lest we set up a statue. In the next talk, called The Four Words, or also The Writing on the Wall, we'll look at a different version of this very same lesson. Look forward to you returning to iFaith 108.